Okay. Thank you very much, Kelly. And I really would like to start by thanking the organizer for allowing me to be here, because it has been a very interesting week so far, and the program and the atmosphere is very good, very interesting. So I'm going to tell you mostly about the evolutionary cell biology of the eukaryotic endomembrane system, which as you know, is one of the defining features of the eukaryotic cell. And so the development and the origin of the system is amazing. It is a big issue also in the evolution of the eukaryotes. How did they develop this new mode of division is also an important issue. And I hope I will have time to reach that towards the end of the talk. And I will illustrate all that by talking about what we call microbiology's platypus, which is also the symbol of our lab here, which is this organism here, which is a bacteria. It's a prokaryote, but as you can already see, it has some features that are usually not observed in eukaryotes. Okay. So some definition here. What we are really interested in is this point here, so the one that some people call the LECA, or you've probably heard about the FICA also, which is kind of a blurry area here at the transition between prokaryote and eukaryotes. So from this LECA, all the eukaryotes supergrouped.
So just for the benefit of people who might not, maybe you could just say what these are. LECA.
Yeah, oh, sorry. So LECA stands for the last eukaryotic common ancestor. So it's it is the very first eukaryotic cell that we can define as the first eukaryote, okay? Sorry. And FICA is the first eukaryotic common ancestor, which is the first cell having all the eukaryotic characteristics, okay? So it's a blurry, it's not really important at this point. Let's stay with the LECA. Mark will enter into more details about the FICA, I guess. So here, of course, we are in the realm of the eukaryotes, and what I will present you are mainly two hypotheses, which one of them is developed by mainly by Joel Dax and Mark Fields, and it's called organelles parallelogues hypothesis. And the other one by myself and Mike Roth and André Chaly at the Rockefeller and UCSF. Oh, and what we do in this top-down approach is that we look at all the characteristics into extant eukaryotes, the actual eukaryotes, the one that we can still observe today. And from those, from this diversity and the things that they have in common, we try to infer what was present here in the FECA. Okay? So that's the top-down approach in the eukaryotic realm. But of course, these organisms there did not appear from out of nowhere. It's coming from most likely a prokaryote. And at some point during this line of evolution, one of those prokaryotes began to develop some eukaryotic features. Some of those organisms deviated, and some of them got extinct. Some of them still exist. But one of them developed enough to become the LECA. Okay? And this is, of course, the eukaryogenesis happening mostly in the prokaryotic realm. And I will show you the opposite of the top-down approach, the bottom-up approach, which is macrobiology's platypus. Okay? I have to say that there is absolutely no directionality in terms of complexity here in the verticality of the talk. I just put the eukaryotes on top, but it should be linear more than vertical. There is no implication of increasing complexity or anything, okay?
Are you going to talk any more about those two different approaches?
Yeah. So I will go now into those two and then in the platypus, okay. Yeah, but I thought that it would be very adapted for this kind of talk to present you something maybe a little bit more hypothetical and a possible scenario that will fill the gaps from a prokaryote without any eukaryotic features to this one, as opposed to the current theory that exists now, which consists of a big jump, basically merging those two to get that without any intermediary steps in between, okay? So it might be a little bit more speculative, but I thought this would be appropriated for this program. So one of the eukaryotic characteristics, the most striking one probably, is the endomembrane system. And in those systems, we have two types of organelles, the endosymbiotic ones, which I will not say much because they're all, most is already known, and we will hear some talks later on during this week, I guess. But the one I will focus now are those ones here, which are expected to have developed by autogenous models, so stepwise models of evolution. But the big question is how something so complex and so developed as this could have evolved from basically from nothing or from very little. Okay? And we know, so the previous hypothesis about the eukaryotic endomembrane system development were mainly involved into other type of hypotheses dealing with bigger changes and bigger scheme in the apparition of the eukaryotes. It's only recently that Mark and Joel and others have begun to address specifically the evolution of the eukaryotic endomembrane system, including the nucleus, of course. So what we know from the top-down approach is that looking at the diversity of current eukaryotes, the eukaryotes that exist now, and looking at the genes that they have, we see that most of those genes are found in all the eukaryotes, all extant eukaryotes. So the most parsimonious explanation is that the LECA, somewhere here, already had all of those genes, and there is only a few gain and loss around along the branches. Okay, this implies that the ancestral eukaryote, the LECA, already had a developed endomembrane system. Okay, so that we know. Because all those genes are everywhere here, they are most likely originated. They were already present at the LECA and originated before the LECA. Okay? That's pretty simple. So, this is the hypothesis of Mark and Joel, the organelle paralogy hypothesis. Looking at the phylogeny, so multiple sequence alignment and phylogeny reconstruction, they realized that duplication and divergence has played a major role in the evolution of those genes. By example, in some lineages, you can see duplication of a few genes that are not found in other organisms, implying that those organelles are paralogs with the other ones and that they have evolved by duplication and divergence and neofunctionalization. Okay, of the system, but also of the proteins and the compartments that are sustained by those proteins. Okay. But so this implies. So this is a schematic of it here. This implies that these ancestral multi-protein complexes that sustain the eukaryotic or part of the eukaryotic endomembrane system, during evolution, duplicated and evolved separately in different branches. Okay. So those organelles are paralogs, so the organelle paralog hypothesis. However, this implies that earlier in time, there were fewer such complexes and fewer such compartments in the eukaryotic endomembrane system. No? So there is an increased, reduced number of genes and fewer spatially separated compartments with potentially functionally less diversified. Okay, that's the OPH, the organelle paralogy hypothesis. And as I said, it's mainly based on sequence analysis and sequence phylogeny. Okay, that's clear? And that's important because there is something very, it's a big problem in eukaryotic analysis, eukaryotic evolution analysis, is that there is a huge sequence signal barrier here at the border of the LECA. In fact, for more than half of the what we define as eukaryotic specific genes, we cannot find any sequence similarity with prokaryotic proteins. Okay, so there is really a huge gap here that we cannot fill for most of the eukaryotic proteins.
So what does that mean, sequence similar area?
So half of the eukaryotic proteins do not have a prokaryotic counterpart.
So you don't mean signal sequence. Sorry.
Yeah. I'm just kidding.
Cell biologists hear signal sequence even though the words are switched. Okay.
No. I mean the sequence the sequence signal is a lot. Well, if any, we don't find any. Okay?
I even wrote signal sequence. Okay, thank you.
No. The sequence.
Did somebody do? I think I saw some. But did somebody do rather than sequence analysis, structural analysis?
Well, you. That's exactly what I want to say. Yes. So to bridge this gap, we use structure because we know that during evolution, structure is more conserved than sequence. So we will look here at those what we call the membrane coating systems. You know that most of those compartments in the eukaryotic cell, latrine, cotyl vesicle, COP1, COP2, and the NPC, they are all sustained by multiprotein complexes, which are huge machinery with a lot of components, especially in the case of the nuclear pore complex. And the relationship is unclear. However, I will show you that those systems are related at least three levels. The first one is obvious. It is the interaction, the close interaction with a bent membrane. Okay, so they are all tightly connected to our membrane that is bent. It's not only the membrane, it's the fact that it is bent membrane. But also structurally, here you have the resolution of four nucleoporins, those ones. And this one is SEC31 from COP2. And structurally, you can see that there is some kind of structural relationship, which is difficult to perceive. So it's very difficult to structurally superimpose those proteins. But we are doing some work on that. But there is, however, a common structural framework linking all those protein complexes. Here, there is only the nuclear pore complex and COP2. But in fact, all of them can be linked similarly through structural similarity.
So, the sequence is completely different, but
yes,
it just so happens that the structure.
Mm-hmm. So,
that's the usual story.
Yeah. So that's what you can see here. Here you have the secondary structure representation for clathrin, COP1 component, COP2 components, and the nuclear pore complex. There is absolutely no sequence relationship between any of those proteins. But if you look at the secondary structure, they are all predicted to have an amino-terminal domain mainly dominated by beta strands that is predicted to fold as at least one beta propeller. And the carboxy terminal is mainly dominated by alpha helices that is predicted to fold as a solenoid or spar domain.
And that is structures known or just predicted?
Those are real structure known, and they are more since then. And we might see that more at the end of the talks. But there are plenty now of such structures confirming this. However, you can see that there is structural similarity, but there is also tremendous differences. The sequence signal, is totally lost. Mm-hmm. So you cannot relate any of those proteins by sequence. It's really only the structure, the secondary structure, and the fold that links them. Okay.
David, how many proteins unrelated to the vesicles of the nuclear pore also have this kind of structural organization?
Yes, that's a very good question. Plenty, because the beta propeller is ubiquitous. The solenoid is also ubiquitous, so you can really find them everywhere in the tree of life, including prokaryotes. So the
together though, and like this.
Well, I'll come to that point. It's a very good question. I'll come to that. But so to answer this question together, no, this is unique. So this architecture, the fact the beta propeller first and then the solenoids, with some variation, this is unique and only found so far. Let's say with so far in those eukaryotic proteins involved in the endomembrane system. So all of them are eukaryotic and involved in the endomembrane system. So telling us that proteins that I will represent like this, with an amino-terminal beta propeller and carboxy-terminal solenoid, have played.
So you use some pretty strong words, right? There's no sequence similarity, but you said that we know from the structure that they're related. So
we can at least see that.
I'd like to believe you, but.
We can at least see. OK, what I mean is that we can at least see that they are structurally related in terms of structure. Do they have a common origin? Is something else. But yeah.
It's a huge debate in structural biology whether structurally similar proteins convergently discover the
diversity.
So,
But that's what I mean about they are related not only by structure, which is here, but also by function. They are all involved in eukaryotic endomembrane system maintenance, but also the architecture, so the combination of those four types in this very specific combination is unique. However, as we said, as those domains are ubiquitous, they could have fused together more than once during evolution. That's a possibility.
Do you have any ideas why this particular architecture would be suited for this function?
Yes, no, and it's a very difficult one because you can already see it here. They are despite those similarities, there are also tremendous differences. Clatrin is maybe the simplest. It's one beta proper and then a long spa domain. But in COP1, we see two beta propeller. In COP2, we see one beta propeller, then a little piece of the beta propeller that complement in trans and other proteins to do something very similar to that. But why does it have to be encoded in two different proteins? We don't know. Then the solenoids here is long and well structured, and here it's short, compact, and there it has an unstructured region linking both of them that you can see also here. But this part, in some nucleoporins, it's actually well structured. So it recapitulates all that, but this fragment here is well structured in the nucleus. Why all those differences that you can probably appreciate better here? We don't know.
Could you just say a few words, general words, about membrane coding systems, what they do in the cell?
So all those proteins are either coating the vesicles, yeah? That's why we call them membrane coating systems. Because the classical one is the clatrin. You know, the clatrin form a cage around the clatrin. Clatrin.
I think you need to go about a few steps back for people who don't know what that is. Or just use this slide to explain. Yeah, this is fine.
Yeah. So the eukaryotic endomembrane system is divided into different compartments. Most of them are linked by vesicular transport that transport the lipids and whatever the cargo from compartments from one to the others. And this is mainly, at least in the case that is of interest here, it's mainly mediated by vesicular transport, okay? Which, in this case, by example, internalization of outside components is mediated by clatrin that pinches off from the membrane and fuse with the lysosomes, and that's how things enter the cell here. So it's a system like that. Receptor on the outside that kind of bud off, the clatrin goes around it, dynamin splits the membrane, and those vesicles then enter the cell. Okay. The nuclear pore complex, I guess you all know, it's a huge multi-protein complexes that defines it's the gate of entry in the nucleus. Okay.
But all the proteins that you're talking about so far are membrane deforming proteins. You're really
yes.
Talking about the green guys up there.
Yeah, and those ones there. So the nuclear proteins are here.
What about all the other ones, the brown ones, and all of the little?
So this is color. COP2, uh-huh. and those shaded structure here are what I call the membrane coat proteins. So in each one of those multi-protein complex, there are plenty of proteins. But in every case, there is at least one. Here it is clatrin, here it is COP alpha, COP beta prime, SEC31, and here plenty of nuclear pore.
But they are not inserted in the membrane, they are water soluble. Right? Yeah, so they are not membrane
proteins. They are not membrane proteins. No. In this case, those are receptors, and in this case, they are particular NUPs that have transmembrane regions. So those are not, they are in tight contact with the membrane, but they are not membrane proteins. Okay. So those proteins have a similar function, they have a similar structure, and they have a similar architecture. Okay. However, they also have tremendous divergences. Okay. In terms of the structure, but also in the way they interact. So the way they multimerize is also very different, and the code that they form is also totally different, even between the coated vesicles, and of course the nuclear pore complex is totally different. But even the coated vesicles, which are related or similar, also show differences. The way those membrane coat proteins interact in each of those complexes is different. Okay, so there are important differences here. However, those structural, architectural, and functional similarity have suggested that the origin of those membrane coat complex were key to the evolution of the evolution of the eukaryotes and to the origin of the eukaryotes. Where at some point, one early eukaryotic-like organism acquire this protein, probably by fusing together two domains that are ubiquitous that you can find everywhere. But that provided him for the first time in evolution with a tremendous advantage, which is to be able to play with this membrane, okay, to invaginate and regulate its membrane. Then, as we have seen with the OPH, duplication and divergence would have led to those systems, the divergence being tremendous in this case. Okay.
One quick question. I have forgotten here, for the playing with membrane to work, there's got to be energy put in to kind of mix things up, and I've forgotten where the energy comes into this system.
I would say that the energy mostly comes during the regulation in this system. But here, I'm not touching the energetic part at all at the moment, because we basically don't have much information. So all the RABs, the GTPs are involved in, and that's also a common point between all those systems, is that including the NPC, they are all regulated by small GTPs. They are all another point of similarity between those systems.
You've also got HSP70, at least some of them, right?
Excuse me?
HSP70 for clathrin is an encoding thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
But I'm not touching the point of the energetics.
I just was, again, thinking about it from the standpoint of evolution, and it's
something... Yeah. It is important. I will say something about that later on.
Okay.
Yeah. But so the proto-coatomer hypothesis are highly complementary to the OPH, states that the origin of those proteins was key to the evolution of the eukaryotic and the membrane system, because we can find them in all such complex in the eukaryotic cell, no? So if we put together the OPH and the PCH, we arrive to a scenario like this, where the situation we observe in the current eukaryotes is the result of the apparition of those proteins and related ones, because they are not the only one involved in those systems, at some point during the transition from a prokaryote to an eukaryote. Duplication and divergence of those systems would have led to the actual situation, okay? But, so what I would like to ask, or to share with you now, is the question of what could this intermediary endomembrane system be like? What shape could it have? What function could it have? Was it first a nuclear envelope that then... What was the nuclear envelope first here and then diverged into an ER that then diverged into an ER and a Golgi, et cetera, et cetera? Or was it first a Golgi? What was the shape and the function of this system?
So there's still no protein with anything resembling this architecture found in any prokaryote?
Yes, there are. And that's next. I will come to that next. Okay, but so what we propose is that maybe a more parsimonious proposal to this is that it was none of them. It was this intermediary system was not a nucleus, was not a Golgi, but it was just a non-differentiated multifunctional network of tubes and vesicles. What we call a TVN, a tubulovesicular network. Okay, and this is supported by. And by the way, this is a proposal that we have just published in Biology this year. And you can find all the details there. So this is a proposal that is supported by some of the forms that we see in current eukaryotes. So by example, COP2, which normally only forms vesicles, you can also see it forming long, extended tubules, probably if there is no pinching of the membrane here, okay? So such systems, such tubulovesicular system, exist in current eukaryotes. And that's what you find also in reduced eukaryotic endomembrane systems like Microsporidia, Entamoeba histolytica, and Giardia. In all of those, all of those are pathogens, and they have, of course, lost some of the components of the endomembrane system. But what we found, the exact organization of the endomembrane system is still unclear, but what is clear is that it's not any of those anymore, Golgi or NER, but it's more an undifferentiated, blurry kind of tubules and vesicles that are connected somehow to the outside and, of course, to the nucleus. So such tubulovesicular network exists in the current eukaryotes.
What was the cell there? What's the boundary of the cell in that?
Here it's here, the plasma membrane. That's the boundary of the cell. This is probably a clathrin coated vesicle.
Wait, it's all the cell, but I don't understand. What do you mean by the nucleus?
Here is the nucleus with the DNA, and this is probably the nuclear envelope here around it. So they are eukaryotes, all of those. They, of course, have a nucleus, but the connection between the nuclear envelope and the cytoplasmic membrane is not that clear, not that differentiated into the classical ER, Golgi, and others. There is just a network of such tubules.
To follow up on Mike's question, are they really implying that the plasma membrane is part of the nuclear boundary, or is that just...
No, not at all. So the plasma membrane is just a typical plasma membrane. But this...
DNA there, it looks like it's against the plasma membrane.
No, that's just a window.
This is just a window.
All part of the cell.
Exactly, The cell is much bigger.
Oh.
And this is just a small zoom inside the cell. The plasma membrane is here and probably goes all around. And same thing with the nucleus. The nucleus here is smaller with the DNA. But the connection between the plasma membrane and the nucleus is here unclear, not filled by the classical. At least those organisms, they do not have some of the classical endomembrane system. And those are different ones that are not found in those organisms. So it's not always the same that is not found.
They do have nuclear pores?
Yes, they do. Yeah. And each one of them at least have one, and actually at least three copies of those membrane-coated proteins. So one for the NPC, most likely, and one for any of the other systems. Okay.
And in all of these, there's a connection between the ER and the nuclear envelope. Or it's all part of the same membrane.
Yeah, I think it's all part of the same. I would not even call it ER. A network of tubules and vesicles. Yes,
yeah.
Undifferentiated.
Yeah.
But I'm not implying here that those are ancestral eukaryotes. We know that most of them are reduced. Reduced meaning the ancestor had a developed classical endomembrane system with the classical components, okay? Okay, so the conclusion from those and the combination of those two highly complementary hypotheses is that the ancestral eukaryotic endomembrane system might have been composed of a tubulovesicular network that was probably multifunctional and undifferentiated. Okay? So we are slowly filling the gaps between those organisms. And then from here. Okay, on the other side, we also know that some bacteria, they also have some kind of membrane organization. So this is the case of the magnetosome. You know, those bacteria, they have some small invagination of the inner membrane where they accumulate the magnetic crystals. The tilacoids, of course, in the classical photosynthetic bacteria. And the anammox, which is a very peculiar organism, part of the plantomycetes. I will not enter into the details, but it has a huge vacuole that contains some specific side product of their metabolism. So they are some kind of endomembrane, the start of the endomembrane development in prokaryotes, in bacteria, okay?
Can you say more about thylakoids? That is, I mean, I know from some illustrations and books that the membrane's architecture is quite elaborate.
Yes. I don't know what else I could say. It's a network of membrane and invagination. It's unclear still if it's connected or not to the inner membrane of the prokaryotes, but it's highly elaborate. Yes, it's mainly laminated. Yes.
So the proteins that allow these invaginations, are they similar in structure to the ones that you have selected?
No, not at all. There is absolutely no protein relationship between any of those systems. But those systems only illustrate the fact that the beginning of the development of an endomembrane system is possible also in eukaryotes. But they are not; those ones are not related to the eukaryotic ones. Or at least we cannot see any sequence signal.
What about
mitochondria? Yeah, no. So for some of them, we do know the proteins that are involved there, and there is no structural relationship in any of those.
So to ask a very naive question about cyanobacteria, so did cyanobacteria have the thylakoids, or is this only plants?
No, those are bacteria, so yes, cyanobacteria. This is only prokaryotes, yes.
What about mitochondrial coding proteins?
Yes, the mitochondrial proteins are more difficult because they all move to the nucleus. So I didn't want to put them in the prokaryotes, but of course they are also some kind of prokaryotic derived endomembrane system. Yes. Shilling?
So this may be a technical question. So why is it not possible to figure out if those internal membranes are actually connected to the plasma membrane, or continuous with the plasma membrane, or there are separate systems?
There has been some studies. So
they can't be, because you need them for to make the proton motor gradient to make ATP. So they have to be isolated from the outside of the cell.
Okay, I thought you said it wasn't.
So in this case, by example, they are still connected. In this case, it's unclear, and in this case, it's probably unconnected. So there is all kind of organization there.
So the point is that they must be, there just isn't any definitive evidence showing that they actually are.
Similar?
EM or something.
I don't think there is any similarity with the eukaryotic endomembrane system here. I'm just putting this slide up to show that intermediary steps towards the development of an endomembrane system is possible also in eukaryotes. That's all. But there is absolutely no relationship between any of those systems and the eukaryotic one. Okay.
So of those examples, I would say the thylakoid is at a level of complexity which almost looks eukaryotic, whereas the other examples.
Yeah, but there is still only one function in those. Than the in terms of functionality.
I just mean naively looking at shapes.
The more developed, let's say, yes. Yes, totally agree. Okay. That has been said. So to come back to the origin of the membrane coat, eukaryotic membrane coat protein, I told you proteins with this kind of architecture are unique, found only in eukaryotic proteins involved in endomembrane system. So we search for the origin of such proteins. And because I told you that structure is more conserved than sequence during evolution, we used a structural approach. So what we did is that we searched for all the proteins in the whole tree of life. So at the time, it was over only 200 genomes, more than 1 million sequences, for which I predicted the four types, and searched for all those ones that have the beta problem. And as we've said, I found them everywhere. This domain is ubiquitous. You can find it everywhere in the tree of life. Same thing for the solenoid. It's everywhere in the tree of life. What is more interesting now is when I try to merge those two sets. Where are the proteins that have both domains in the same protein, encoded in the same protein? And again, this is found everywhere in the tree of life. So I don't represent here, but you would have peaks everywhere, because all those organisms, so most likely all living organisms, have proteins that are composed of those two domains. But
did you restrict it?
Exactly. So that's the next step. So now if we restrict that to those proteins that only have those two domains and only in this particular architecture, what do we find?
Another question I didn't quite understand. You said there are almost no sequence similarity between sequences of these two domains. So how did you construct this hidden Markov models?
This is only a structural prediction. So I took all the... I just did a HH search on all those proteins. So predicting the structure of those proteins independently of what domains they hit. So they could hit any type of beta propeller, even some that are not related in sequences. This is just structural prediction.
What kind? How did you do it?
HH search, so Heisenberg-Markov models only. So we have a database of Heisenberg-Markov models for all the protein in the PDB. We derive Heisenberg-Markov models for all the proteins in those genomes, and we match them. Okay, so you could have any kind of hits here to different beta propeller or solenoids. Okay, just predicting where do we see proteins with those type of folds without caring about the sequence relationship between them. Okay? Just looking at the structural level here. So this is purely based on structure now. And you will see that in the next slide. So where do we find those? Of course, only in the eukaryotes. At least three such copies in all of them. Three for the parasite that have lost some of them. Didn't find any in the archaea, at least at the time. And didn't find any in bacteria here in blue. Except in this very small set of organisms. Okay, so there is only one bacterial phylum that has this kind of proteins with this particular organization in the whole tree of life. So this slide just to convince you that those proteins, those are now the bacterial proteins that I just detected and that I linked to the eukaryotic one that we have already seen. Okay, so you would agree with me that in terms of secondary structure and the prediction of all how those proteins fold in space, there are similarities. There are, of course, differences. And again, if you start from the sequence of any of those and do even remote search, sequence search, you cannot link those two sets of proteins. It's purely structural based. Okay?
You say purely structure based, I still don't quite understand. So there is no sequence similarity, so you construct your whatever multiple alignments based on structure superpositions of these domains.
No. So in this case, I just took those sequences, mm-hmm. build an Heisenberg-Markov models, and match that with the Heisenberg-Markov models of the PDB.
Yeah, but how you build Heisenberg-Markov models if there are almost no similarity? How construct alignments?
So there is no similarity between those, but those have sequence similarity to other proteins.
Okay. Which so it's enough to build that.
Other proteins to build the profile and the HMM, and then I do the same with the PDB ones, but. So when I say there is no sequence, I mean that the hit here, the structural hit, is not one of those nuclear proteins. It's just a beta propeller, any type of beta propeller. It could be something else. Okay. But this is predicted to fold as a beta propeller, and this is predicted to fold as a solenoid, which is strikingly similar to what we see in the eukaryotic case. Despite that, there is still no sequence relationship. So you can use the most up-to-date methods and tools and database to link those by sequence. By sequence, there is no, you do not find any relationship. You really need to pass by the structure.
But okay? It's still some sort of sequence relationship that way how you build the HMM, because there still can be an unsurmountable breach so that you will have another profile corresponding to the same
indeed
topology, etc., which you are simply missing in this HMM.
Well, yes, but also, in fact, most of the structure that we hit here to predict the structure of those are related to the eukaryotic one. So there is some kind of sequence relationship.
Right. No, that's definitely true. What I'm trying to say is something the opposite. That the fact that you found it only in a small subset of prokaryotes does not mean that proteins with similar architecture do not exist in other bacterial species. You simply kind of your HMM simply doesn't reach to them.
No, that's possible. That's what we don't see. Yeah.
Are you trying to say that structural prediction programs don't apply to those
exactly? Exactly. They simply kind of they.
But why? It's really based on just fundamental biophysical properties of.
No. It is not. That's exactly the point. That HMM are not based on fundamental biophysical.
Well, it's
not the normal prediction.
But Because HMM is just a, isn't it just structure prediction of the linear protein sequence? Or
no,
is
HMM
more?
Is really sequence based.
Yeah.
So it's really a profile from which we. So a profile is just a statistic.
Yeah, okay, I guess I was unclear. I thought you were.
So like, HMM is just based on multi-sequence alignment.
But why can't you just do a pure structural search based on a long stretch of?
But that's what I did. It's basically the.
But then what's the HMM for?
The HMM is to be able to reach further away than, so to expand the sequence signal that you have in your. In your sequence.
Okay, so first you find these structures and then you construct it.
So the first thing you do, you start with this sequence and you search for all the homologs. And here you have a long profile with the sequence divergence.
Right. So you're finding these new ones and new ones based on structure, then you're making an HMM out of these.
No. I'm finding the structure of those based on the HMM. I'm finding the structure of all of those based on the HMM, based on the sequence.
But HMM is still a sort of a fancy way to align sequences.
Sure.
It's a fancy sequence alignment tool which allows you to go deeper than standard whatever tools or sequences.
Statistically, a bit more powerful, that's all.
But I still don't understand why you can't. I mean, structural prediction programs are pretty good.
No. They are pretty bad.
Yeah. Even for alpha helix and beta sheet. It's not good at predicting the perfect structure, but for secondary structure, it's bad. Right?
So secondary structure is pretty good, but that's all you get. This is secondary structure prediction. But from this, you don't know the fold. It just predicts the secondary structure of those proteins. And this is pretty good.
Okay,
yes.
So that's not enough.
This is only linear. This only tells you this part is mainly all alpha, this part is mainly beta, but it does not tell you the fold. It does not tell you how those things are organized in 3D. Which is why I need to use the HMM to predict the three-dimensional structure of those proteins.
So the universe of proteins that look like this in secondary structure is much larger than the proteins that you identified in
Search.
Okay.
The universe of proteins that look like this is larger than the one that look like this.
Yeah, well, secondary structure is absolutely insufficient to predict the fold. Yeah. You can know secondary structure and have no clue about three-dimensional structure.
Sure, yeah.
Which is the basic of the problem in structure prediction.
Yeah. But you're right that those are maybe, secondary structure is maybe the most accurate method of prediction so far. More or less.
And so, Damien, if you did a secondary structure prediction and use that as a search, you'd get a lot of false positives,
I think so.
And you would know they were false positives because what? Because they are known to have a different structure, or you just don't know the structure?
No, if you don't know the structure, you would not know that they are false positive. They would be false positive.
There would be a lot of hits.
Yeah.
A lot more to search there.
Yeah. But anyway, we can discuss that later, but let me, because I'd like to continue with that. So those bacterial proteins.
I'd just like to request that after you have this discussion, that somebody comes back and tells everybody else how you guys settled this out, so that we can understand what this is all about. Yeah.
No, we can continue if you. Is it clear? Or
I think I understand better now. I just misunderstood your approach to begin with.
But the approach is that it's. Very difficult to scan this quantity of. So here I scan more than 1 billion sequences. So I need something that is fast and relatively accurate. So I you're right. I could have done it at the secondary structure level, but there would be a lot of noise there. So it's slightly more accurate or more informative to pass by the structure, the three-dimensional structure.
Well, it's a more stringent filter.
Yeah,
but that also means you're. Throwing out things, you're going to have a lot of false negatives, which is okay. I mean, you've got to start somewhere.
Yeah, no, yeah, that I agree. But despite that, I still found something that is of interest.
Right.
Okay, so here we have the bacterial sequences that looks like the eukaryotic one. Where are they coming from? So they are coming from a very obscure bacterial phylum, which is the one we study. It's called PVC for planktomycetes, very comicrobiae, and also contains the chlamydia, which is probably the most described ones. We also have the Lentisphera and some uncultured group in this superphylum. But the surprise, so when I had these three detection and when I found those proteins in those bacteria, I didn't know anything about planktomycetes. Anyway, I'm a biologist, but I have never heard the name planktomycetes. And I am a microbiologist. So I thought this is a false positive, as we just said. It's unlikely. However, when I looked at those bacteria, what I saw is this. So those are bacteria. Those are the bacteria that do contain those proteins that have this typical architecture linked to the origin of the eukaryotic and the membrane system. And in those bacteria, you find membrane organization that are unique for bacteria. So you do not find any prokaryote that have this. So just to tell you, so this is here on the outside is the outer membrane. On the inside is the inner membrane, and between those is what we call the periplasm in prokaryotes. Okay, so and you can see that the inner membrane sends invaginations toward the inside of the cell, and so the space here is continuous with the periplasm. So this is basically internalized periplasm here. Okay. Sometimes those invaginations they seem to fuse and to form a diffuse space here. Sometimes, very strikingly, this seems to surround the DNA or the genetic material that you can see here. Another particularity of those bacteria is that the genetic material is condensed, so you can see it very clearly. And those are bacteria. You don't see that normally in bacteria in terms of the condensed DNA, or at least not in all of them. Sometimes they seem to divide the cytoplasm into different compartments, some kind of more elaborate membrane structure, and sometimes some kind of vesicle seems to be present in the periplasm with different composition, okay? So this is very unique, this is very rare, and this is very surprising that those bacteria that have the most developed endomembrane system are the one with those proteins that look like the eukaryotic one, yes?
So is there any evidence that these different endomembrane systems in prokaryotes arose via horizontal gene transfer? Are you thoroughly confident that these represent independent evolutions?
Yeah, that's a possibility, and of course, that's probably the first reaction when you see this kind of tree. You think that those proteins must have come from lateral gene transfer from there. So we looked at that. We've looked at the genomes, and at least in terms of the classical sign of lateral gene transfer, like GC content and codon bias, we do not see any evidence of those. But maybe it's just too ancient, and the signal has been lost. We don't know. Okay. But it is definitely a possibility, and probably the most likely one, that is lateral gene transfer. Yes.
What are the scale bars here?
So this is 500 microns.
The curvature is kind of comparable to the eukaryotic.
They are slightly bigger than a bacteria.
500 microns?
Nanometer, sorry. So the one bacteria is 3 to 4 microns wide, which is slightly bigger than the classical bacteria. The genome is also slightly bigger. It can go up to 10 megabases, so close to double your classical bacterial genome. Yes?
And you see the same internal membranes in all of these other organisms where you found?
No, so here they are, okay. All those organisms. So this is the classical bacteria, Escherichia coli, outer membrane in gray, inner in dark, and the space in between them that's the periplasm here in light gray. So in the chlamydia, by example, we do not see any of those membrane organization. But then in the planktomycetes, sometimes we see some which have just a very enlarged periplasm. Sometimes there is the beginning of a huge vesicle or invagination in the towards the cytoplasm. One of them, the anammox, has this very peculiar vacuole-like structure in the cytoplasm. And then there is different kind of membrane invagination or outer membrane evaginations towards the outside and complex. It's not very clear how the membrane organized here. But it's also not very clear how those organize in this organism that we study, so the gamma obscura globus. And in this, you will see that we see invagination of the inner membrane. But So in the next slide, we will go through one such bacteria in three dimensions. So we acquire, we cut the bacteria in many slices acquired by electron microscopy.
So do these have twice as many genes as E. coli or some kind of DNA?
Yeah, it's towards twice as many genes, yes. So here we go through one such bacteria to have a better look at the inside of organization of the membrane. Okay, we just go through. You have seen also that this is budding because we are this one is budding and the bud is mainly empty of membrane. And we wanted to follow the organization of the membrane here. So the first thing you can see that we have an excellent resolution of the membrane. But if you follow any of those compartments that might seem to form at some point, and here we go and reconstruct it in 3D. If you follow any of those compartments that you can see here, by example, they are never closed. They never form a closed compartment, which is one important step of the eukaryotic endomembrane system. So maybe I can just play it back. So all of those pseudo-compartments that seems to form at some point, that at some point might seem to surround the DNA, are actually never closed to themselves. They are always all connected and open to the rest of the cytoplasm. So there is no compartmentalization of the cytoplasm yet, okay, in those bacteria. Yes?
Can you say something about the ecology of these
bacteria? Yeah, they are ubiquitous. They live everywhere. In the soil, in water, seawater, fresh water. The anammox has been found in the depuration. So they are really ubiquitous, and the chlamydia, of course, they are internal pathogens. So they are really a lot of things happening here.
So those membrane systems are present at all times during the life cycle, you think?
Well, that's what we don't know. Here, by example, yes, they are present in all time of the cell cycle, yes. But what we don't know is in this case, by example, in the case of gemata, we see two type of cells. We just seen the first one with the invagination of the inner membrane. But in the other one, we see the opposite. So those are the same organism, and we don't know how they are related with time, with age, with the culture, condition, whatever. We don't know that. What we seem to know is that this one appears to be the one budding, the one dividing. Okay, that's another particularity of those bacteria we will see later on, is that they are budding. They don't divide by binary fission.
So I guess you're probably going to it, but I can't wait to ask anyway. Have you looked to see if those proteins you identified are actually on those membranes?
Yes, we'll come to that in the next slide. Of course, that's the obvious question. So,
And are those vesicles or not still?
Yeah.
Yeah,
I will come to that too. Let me finish with the type 1 first. So type 1, we saw an extended development of the endomembrane system, but no closed compartment. That's important because those bacteria, they have been previously reported, they have been called the nucleated prokaryotes. Because sometimes you could see them like that, and I have shown you one such slide. Sometimes you can see that the membrane seems to surround the DNA. But what we've seen in the three-dimensional reconstruction is that it's not like that. It's just a lucky cut at some angle and disposition of the membrane. Okay, so there is no such things. We can cross that out. There is no such thing as the nucleated bacteria. Okay, now to the other type. So this is one type of cell. The other types, the first type has invagination of the inner membrane. The other type seems to be the periplasm seems to be populated by vesicles. And we did the same thing. We went back to the cell and went through it in...
When you say types, is this a polymorphism in population or developmental stage?
Again, we don't know. We don't know. So we think that the other type is the one that is budding, the one that is dividing. So we have never seen this type dividing. So we think that it's really some question of the cell cycle. But we don't know yet.
Same prep, you would see.
Yeah, exactly. In the same prep, we would see two different kind of cells.
In the same one.
Preparation, so in the same culture, but the proportion can vary, depending. So back to this one. Here is another cell. This is the outer membrane here. This is the inner membrane. So the cytoplasm is mainly here with the DNA. Condensed DNA, and you can see that the periplasm, the space between the inner and the outer membrane is populated with vesicles. A lot of vesicles there, apparently. But if you see more closely, you can see that there is so many vesicles that some of them at some point connect with the inner membrane, and they seem to be connected to each other, even.
A lot of these black dots are sitting on the membrane. Are those ribosomes?
Those are ribosomes, yes. Yes.
What is that straight thing that looks like a centrosome or something?
Yeah, no, we have no idea what it is. Some kind of filament that will appear here at some point.
Right in there.
Here, this thing moving, we don't know what it is. Some kind of multimer they are in the cytoplasm. Anyway, so what we do see is that those vesicles or vesicle-like structure are actually connected. So if we zoom in at a different level of this movie, we clearly see a connection between all those vesicles. Even connection between vesicles of different content, or at least darkness of their contents, okay? Implying that there might be regulation here between the transfer of those.
Sorry, just the technical stuff. This is amino acetate, or what is it?
No. Yes, I think it's amino acetate, yes. But what we do see also is that some of them, of those vesicles, are connected. They're clearly connected to the outer membrane here. Some of them are connected to the inner membrane, clearly. And those are all connected to each other, to intermediary vesicles inside the pre-plasmon. Okay, you will see that better in the next slide. So you just saw this one is all connected to the outside. Some of them are connected to the inside, and they are all of them connected to each other inside here. So really forming a tubulus vesicular network in the periplasm of those bacteria. So you will see it here. All of those vesicles, they are connected to each other, really forming a network of tubules and vesicles in the periplasm.
Do they have anything like a dynamen, like
those constructions? Yeah, it's one of those that is difficult to find, because the fold is, let's say, it's prone to false positives. So they have proteins that in terms of sequence, the answer is the classical one. No, we do not see anything that looks like the sequence of the dynamic. I search using structure, and it's again there are things related structurally, but I cannot have a definite answer. Okay. Anyway, this just demonstrates that the development of a development dynamic and the membrane system is possible even in a prokaryote. But of course, the question is, where are those coming from? Is this lateral gene transfer? Is this just a convergence to the same fold type, because those domains are ubiquitous? So where are those proteins coming from? So to answer your previous question, we raised antibody against those, and we went back to the cells. And indeed, each time you can see that the gold label that is on the secondary antibody recognizing the first antibody against this protein is always found in tight interaction with the membrane. And we have some statistics about it. But so those proteins that look like the eukaryotic and the membrane system proteins, they are found in the periplasm of those bacteria, the space between the inner and the outer membrane. And they are most of the time found in tight interaction with the membrane.
So it's not always on the convex or the concave side of it.
No, exactly. That's a very good observation. And some of them are just lost in the periplasm, as if they were. Or maybe there is some membrane organization we don't see, or they're just waiting or just synthesized. I don't know. Yes.
Is each dot a molecule?
Excuse me?
Each dot here,
this is gold particle.
Oh.
Conjugated to the secondary antibody that recognizes the first antibody against this protein. Okay. So each dot, each very dark dot here. So this one there, or each one with an arrow, let's say. Those dots here are the ribosomes. And that's how we can follow the that's how we can differentiate the periplan from the cytoplasm, because those.
But the number of dots is not really indicative of how many molecules are on the vesicles.
No, not at all. No. I would guess that there are much more molecules. Yes.
How does this image compare if you did a similar analysis to COP1 or COP2 components in eukaryotes?
We talked about that. It's a difficult one because I would say that the eukaryotic ones are much more transient, so they come and go to around the vesicle. In the case of the NPC, you will clearly see something like that, but that's because the NPC is stable. The NPC there and stay there, and the dots will be right on the pore. So there are plenty of images like that. In the case of the, you know, the traveling ones, that's more difficult. They would look like that at some point of the synthesis, and they do. There are some images, but not the same, but related. Again, that's I think the fairest answer. Again,
also these vesicles are all different sizes.
Yeah. You can find the same thing in the eukaryotic one too. They are variables. So.
Is it just binding to the membrane that these proteins just they have some affinity to the membrane or some traces of active transport to membrane?
Yeah, we don't know. This is really the beginning of the analysis of those systems, and we really don't know anything. One of the problems of those bacteria is that they grow very slowly. It takes at least 7 days on a petri dish to see something. So it's not easy to work with them, and I think we are among the first to analyze them really that much. So we don't know anything about. It's a very good question. We don't know. We would like to know. Yes.
So in your observation, they're exclusively residing in the intermembrane spaces instead of cytoplasm.
Yes, they do, yeah. So it's opposite to the eukaryotic one, yes. Yeah.
So can you express this protein some other
way? Yes. Yeah, we did that. We played with that. But nothing happens. No, but so the hypothesis is that those proteins are necessary but not sufficient for the other membrane system. You know, they are in eukaryotes, there is a lot of adapter, regulator, and other proteins that do help them in the behavior. So it's probably not enough. So and we don't know the other components. That's one of the things we are trying to do now, is to pull down the partners of those proteins. And I'm really much looking forward to that. That would be very interesting. But so far, we don't know.
But do you
overexpress
them where?
Escherichia coli. We overexpress them. That's how we clone them and then express them, purify them, and derive the antibodies.
Do they? Are they soluble? Do they self-associate?
Like, yeah, they are fairly soluble. If we overexpress them too much, they precipitate. But you know that happens.
But if they don't make, for instance, tubes or polymers in them.
Excuse me?
They don't make, for instance, tubes or
No. So we look at the membrane of those Escherichia coli expressing those proteins, and we have not seen any differences yet. No.
Do you ever catch dividing cells in your
yes. DNA? Yes. Yeah.
Anything interesting happening with the?
We can see sometimes the DNA, the condensed DNA going through. Yes.
But in terms of the endomembrane system, do you see any interesting symmetries or partitioning or?
No symmetry, not at all, because those are budding. So sometimes you just see a very small bud just starting to grow on the big mother cell, and then we see the bud and the neck of the bud growing.
So the prokaryote of the bud.
Yeah, I'll come to that. That's next.
Okay.
If I reach that. So the conclusion of those two is that the development of the I don't like to say complex, but of a developed and dynamic endomembrane system is possible in eukaryotes. And this is in agreement with an hypothesis that has been put up more than 30 years ago by two Nobel Prize independently, de Duve and Blubel, in the 80s, where they state that the origin of this system is to be found in the internalization of the periplasm. Okay, and they state that because those two systems, they share those proteins and more that are homologous. So in this case, they are really homologous between the prokaryotic periplasm and the eukaryotic endomembrane system, suggesting them that the origin of the eukaryotic endomembrane system was due to the internalization of the periplasm. Okay? But if you think about it, that's exactly what I've showed you with those bacteria. Because I told you those are invagination of the inner membrane. And the space here is continuous with the periplasm. So this is really an intermediary organism illustrating this possibility. Again, I'm not saying that this is the eukaryotic ancestor. That's not what I said. I'm just saying that this supports this possibility. Okay? That the origin of the eukaryotic endomembrane system is due to the internalization of the bacterial periplasm. So, of course, if we want to push it further and if we want to interpret too literally this kind of tree and this observation and the localization of those proteins along the endomembrane system of those bacteria, it might suggest that the bacterial PVC superphylum might have contributed to the origin of the eukaryotic endomembrane system, but we do not have any evidence for that. Okay? There's absolutely no sequence signal. It's all based on structure and function. Just, I don't want to spend too much time here. This is just too speculative. But then those two approaches, the top-down, suggest that the ancestral eukaryotic membrane system could have been an undifferentiated multifunctional TVN, which is kind of what we see in those bacteria, so kind of bridging the gap between those intermediary evolutionary states. Okay. Now, if we want to push it a little bit further, we can also go and look in the archaeas. You know that the archaeas, usually they only have a cytoplasmic membrane and no other membrane separated by the pseudopeptidoglycan here. So that's the classical archaea, only one membrane. Well, recently, some archaeas have been described as having two membranes, an inner membrane and an outer membrane. So those are the only four which have been described so far, and that are strikingly surprising because it's the first time that archaeas have been described with two endomembrane system. And in at least some cases, you can see that the organization that we observe, we have no idea about the three-dimensional organization of those here. But in those two, at least, we can also see some kind of vesicles and maybe connected tubules in the periplasm of those archaea. So those are our archaea. Those are also strikingly. So we can see a tubular vesicular network in the three domains of life. That's the only thing that this slide wants to illustrate, okay?
So is your model that, like, these proteins were mutating very fast, or that some other gene like sort of replaced its function because it worked better in the eukaryotic ancestor?
No, I don't think that they are. No. I think it's too early to have been modeled at any point yet. This is fairly new. So here I'm just organizing those organisms in terms of endomembrane development. Okay, that's what the triangle represents here in the background. I'm not implying at all any evolutionary relationship between any of those. I'm just saying that intermediary steps from a eukaryote with one of two membranes to a fully developed prokaryote without an endomembrane system, to a fully developed eukaryote with a complete endomembrane system is possible and is observed in nature. Yes?
Am I remembering correctly that earlier you said that the PVC bacteria have a substantial amount of junk DNA?
I think I asked for that about that and you said no.
No, yeah, I'm not.
Okay,
so they have a big genome.
Mm-hmm.
The organization of the proteins in this genome is unclear, so it seems to be way less organized in operons than in classical bacteria, by example. It's bigger in some cases, but of course the chlamydia, by example, they are parasites, so they are the opposite. It's extremely reduced. But those, not those, but the gamata, the one we've seen in 3D, is almost double to the classical bacteria. So, and the organization is unclear. That's it.
Okay. Is there an unlikely to be any relationship between, say, TE contents and the presence of these embedded operating systems?
I don't know about that. No. Why would there be?
I was just thinking, maybe there are a lot of transposable elements that could be solved.
Yes. I'm not aware of any analysis that is look at that, let's say. That would be interesting to do, yes. Yes? Okay. So I think I presented you most of what I wanted to present you, which is basically that they are intermediary systems that kind of fill these gaps here. And if you are aware of publication that we have discussed recently here, Bill Martin and others have suggested that the mitochondria was key to the evolution of the eukaryotes, at least, including the fact that it was necessary to the evolution of the endomembrane system. This scenario favors more mitochondria late development of the mitochondria, because some prokaryotes could achieve quite an impressive development of the endomembrane system without anything related to the mitochondria. No? Okay. How long do I have?
10 minutes.
10 minutes. So I will switch to the next. Okay, now I have to tell you about the platypus, but real quick. But I'd like to go to the division one then later on. So I've just spent most of the time telling you about the cell plan of those bacteria. I've told you that they also have condensed DNA. Very surprisingly, in those bacteria, we can see other characteristics that are usually not found in bacteria, that are usually more associated to eukaryotes, but not only eukaryotes, also with archaeas. And you know that the evolutionary history of archaea and eukaryotes are intimately linked, so it's important. And they are not found in all PVCs. Some of them are found only in Verrucomicrobia, some of them only in Planktomycetes, et cetera, et cetera. Some of them are very striking ones. By example, the Planktomycetes, they are amongst the few bacteria that do synthesize sterol. But they are the only one for which a lateral gene transfer has not been clearly established. Okay? So there are very few bacteria that synthesize sterol. Sterol is usually taken as a eukaryotic specific features. Those ones, they have it. They also divide by budding. We'll come to that. They also have ether lipids, which is a feature usually found in archaea. That's actually what differentiates the lipids of eukaryotes and prokaryotes. Oh, sorry, of eukaryotes bacteria from the archaeal ones. This is found in the Planktomycetes. They have lost FTSZ. I hope we will come to that. Some of them have tubulin. Some of them have methanogenesis, methanophily, and other type of internalization of compounds. So I will not take too much time. For most of those systems, we don't even know how they do it, so we cannot evaluate the origin. For the ones we know, like the membrane coat I just presented you, there is no sign of sequence similarity. However, importantly, that does not mean that they are not related. It could be lateral gene transfer. It could be convergence. But we say that the similarity of features, and maybe the fact that it's not only one thing, but it's all of them, suggest, but again, we have no evidence about anything, just suggest that there might be some kind of relationship between those bacteria and the ancestor of the eukaryote. But this is pure speculation. And this is why we call it the platypus of microbiology. You know the platypus? The platypus is this weird organism that has features that are normally found with us, the mammals, but also with birds and reptiles. Why that? Because we have shared a common ancestor with the platypus and with those guys here. So we suggest that this list that we see here might be the microbiological equivalent of what we see in the platypus. Not that those are the common ancestor, but that maybe at some point we've shared a common ancestor. Again, no evidence, and I really would like to go to the next point, which is a division. Division of those bacteria. We have the chlamydia here, Lanthisphaera, Verrucomicrobia, and the Planktomycetes. Those two, they divide, apparently, with a classical bacterial mechanisms of FTSZ-based division. Surprisingly, in those two, chlamydia and planktomycetes, we don't find any sign of FTSZ. And FTSZ is a protein that is very well characterized in terms of structure and sequences. It has very typical blocks of sequence that we can relatively easily detect. And I have searched very hard in the genome of those bacteria, and I do not find any sign of FTSZ.
But did you find histotubulin or something like that?
Yeah, in some of them, yes, in the vericomicrobia, it is described in there. But right. So the proteins here, so they have both. Those vericomicrobia, they have both tubulin and FTSZ. And clearly, one of the proteins looks much more like FTSZ, and the other one is a bizarre tubulin, but it is much closer to tubulin than to FTSZ.
But maybe it functions as FTSZ,
So the FTSZ of the vericomicrobia is expected to function as an FTSZ, but the tubulin-like protein is also multimerized, but it does not form a 13 protofilaments, 13 subunits protofilaments. It's a 5 subunits protofilaments. And it has structural and regulatory features that are not quite like the eukaryotic one. But it's also not quite the prokaryotic one because it's supposed not to be in prokaryotes. So it's surprising. The other point related to that is that all of those bacteria here, they divide by the classical bacterial prokaryotic FTSZ-based binary fusion. Those ones, the budding planktomycetes, as we've seen, they divide by budding. They divide by budding without FTSZ. So given these three, it's very likely that the ancestor of those organisms, the last PVC common ancestor, was a classical bacteria with a FTSZ-based binary fusion division mechanism. And you can see it here. All those are the Lantisphera chlamydia and the vericomicrobia dividing by that classical binary fission. This is the planktomycetes dividing by budding. Okay? So very different. If we go to the DCW cluster, which is a gene, DCW stands for division and cell wall synthesis cluster, which in most eukaryotes form a closed operons that is very easy to analyze. We see that most of the genes involved in peptidoglycans are there. So they have a classical-like peptidoglycans. But some of the genes, especially the FTSZ genes, they have been differentially lost. So we have just seen the FTSZ. It's found in vericomicrobia and Lantisphera. It's found in 9 out of the 10 genomes analyzed. There is only one genome for the Lantisphera, but it's found there. But it's not found in chlamydia, and it's not found in planktomycetes, being budding of fission. So they are also planktomycetes dividing by the apparently classical binary fission, but they don't have FTSZ. Yes?
Once you have those bacteria which have budding, is it known what determines the budding site?
No. Again, we are probably the pioneers in analyzing those bacteria so far, so we don't know anything. And this is one of the first such analyses. So now we've seen here that all those genes, so MREB, ROTZ, which are interacting, MC, FTSZ, etc., they are present mostly. Maybe the most interesting one and the one we analyze now are those FTSI, W, and P, because they seem to be present in half of the one that divide by budding. So they kind of can be lost, but are not lost in all of them. So now we are trying to look at those, and then we will look at all the other classical ones to see where they localize and what could determine the division. And this is summarized here. So what's interesting is and this is really the evolutionary cell biology of the division mode. So this probably represents the ancestor of the PVC that was dividing by a classical binary fission and has most of the genes, including FTSZ, okay, that forms the concentric ring here, dividing the cell. And this is found in the current vericomicrobia. However, if we go, I don't know if I can say down, but if we move along, we see that FTSZ has been lost, and then there is different kind of component of this system that has been lost. But still, all those divide by apparently a classical binary division. So binary fission. At least from the outside, it looks like that. How they do that without FTSZ It's totally unknown. We still don't know. And the next step is, how do you switch from this to a budding one without having lost most of the components? Because most of those ones that are left are actually involved in the synthesis of the peptidoglycan or in interaction with the peptidoglycan. This is totally unknown. And this is most of what I wanted to tell you. So most of the story about the eukaryotic one, so the top-down approach was developed first in the lab of Mike Roth at the Rockefeller and then at UCSF with Andrek Schally. Most of the analysis of the gemata was done at the MBL in Heidelberg, Germany, in the lab of Jan Matthai, and with the tremendous help of Rachel Santarella, collaboration with those people, and the Platypus Lab is so far composed of those guys there. And if you have more questions, I'll be glad to try to answer them.
So your talk jogged my memory about a paper that I took a few minutes to pull up, but it's was published this year, and it's about the identification of this archaeal group that's very, well, the sister group, supposedly, to...
Loki.
Yeah, the Loki. Yeah. So what can you tell us about how the Loki bacteria fit into your hypothesis, because there are some...
So the Loki is not a bacteria, it's an archaea.
Archaea, yeah.
So that's important. So, because we know that the evolutionary history of the eukaryotes is intimately linked to the archaeal one, and the Loki is probably the closest archaea found so far, at least in terms of domain of genome or composition.
But it has some of these membrane vesicles.
So what, that's the point about the Loki, we don't know, because nobody has seen it.
Wait, but it has the proteins.
So we have the genome and the proteomes. I've talked directly with the last author, with Time, of the paper, and he has not looked at the presence of those proteins in the genomes, in the proteome. I'd like to do that. If he's listening to, well, he knows. Anyway. So the point is that we just have the genome of this organism. We don't know. We have never seen it. It has never been isolated. They just dig down its environmental metagenomics.
Right, but there are homologs of some of the vesicle eukaryotic.
Yeah, totally, yes. There are plenty of eukaryotic signature in this genome of an archaea. So it's highly related to the origin of the eukaryotes, of course. Yeah.
But that doesn't change your thinking about the origin of...
No, it would...
We
don't know... They have some annotated genes that
yes.
are related to vesicle?
Yes.
Yeah. They do have plenty of...
Some remarkably eukaryotic-like genes in their genome.
Including some involved in the development of the endomembrane system.
Right.
But the point is that we have never seen...
Like COP1, COP2 type things? Or?
That I'm not sure.
I've got the paper pulled up, so if anyone wants to look at it, it's an interesting paper, but I don't know how to. Yeah.
But again, so I'm just saying here that there are other.
Put it on the wiki. The wiki. Yeah. That's the answer.
Put it on the wiki?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, I'll try. Somebody will have to make sure that I've signed it.
But so to answer your question, there are other bacteria that do have. We know have some kind of endomembrane system development. How the Loki will fit in this picture, I suspect that it will have something even more developed, but we have never seen it. That's the problem so far with the Loki. I think it's too early to say anything. So I think it will fit in this picture anyway by providing another archaeal example that is probably much closer to the eukaryotic one. Yes.
I imagine this is something that you're presently working on, but I was curious about the MREB and whether or not you think that might, because there's this whole mystery as to why bacteria use tubulin divide and we use actin, but you've still got the actin homolog. I'm curious if the sequence is unusual or...
So it's there. We see it. We have MREB in all of those genomes. MREC is kind of in between in the budding one, and MRED is lost. But B is definitely there.
Not all eukaryotes use actin to divide, just to be clear.
cool.
In LG, actin is a non-essential gene, so it's all microtubule based. Much the same in plants, although I think there is some actin required, but it's a much more microtubular process.
But the microtubules aren't at the creating the well, time is short.
So
I mean, we'll talk more about that. But in any case, is it unusual sequence?
So it may be there. I have not seen anything unusual yet, but I didn't look deeply yet. But it's clearly there, and at least not different enough not to be recognized by classical sequence search tools.
Is there any relation between cell shape and some of these genes that you observe, which ones are more elongated, less elongated, more spherical?
No, there is a diversity of cell shape in those bacteria, but a direct relationship with the gene presence, it has not been done, at least. Nothing that I'm aware of. But there are plenty of diversity.
No analogs of MIND, right? Or MIND-C system?
Yeah, I think I've looked at that. I think they are lost. I think I've looked at that. I have to go back. I think they have not seen them in those bacteria. If not, they would be here, I think. But I've looked at it, yes.
Increasing energy generating area has been increased in PVC by invagination.
Yeah, that's the point. We don't know why they have those invaginations. Okay, maybe I can give you. I kept this slide for the last part.
You did say they're very slow growing, right?
They are very slow growing. But look at this, and I will finish with that. What is this? This is a very simple experiment. It's a bit controversial, so I didn't want to bring it up. So what we have done here is just grow the bacteria in liquid medium, inject commercial GFP in the medium, so not in the bacteria, in the medium. Let them do the things
just
for...
Free GFP,
free floating GFP in the medium. Let them do the things for a couple of hours, then rinse away the medium, resuspend them, and look at them under the microscope. And what you see is that. So if you do that with any other bacteria, you would not see anything. It will all be dark. The fact that the bacteria turned green means that they have internalized the GFP before degradation. And we've seen that it's associated with the vesicle. So the GFP is found inside some of those vesicles. So that comes back to your question, why the endomembrane system? I don't know if it's energy related like the mitochondria, but it's certainly something related to feeding. Can we call that endocytosis as in the carrot? I don't know. But those, the fact is that those bacteria, they internalize proteins before degrading them. And we can see that they degrade them later on, because if we use pro form of the GSP that is only fluorescent after degradation, we can see the signal appearing and getting lost in the cell. So there is some functional relationship with this endomembrane system, but I don't know about the energy. I mean, feeding is energy related, of course, but...
These guys have a wall, right?
They have a peptidoglycan, yes. And that's another question. How does it go through the wall?
Yeah.
But also, if you go back to this this movie, or the how is the tubulovesicular network organized? There, somewhere there, in between the EM and the RM, is the peptidoglycan. We just don't see it, but how does it organize around those vesicles? It's probably somewhere there, the peptidoglycan. How it opens and let the vesicles go through, I don't know. Again, we are really at the beginning of studying those. Yes?
So there was a question in the talk about how to compare the periplasmic vesicles with vesicles you see in the eukaryote.
Yes.
What struck me was the size distribution of your vesicles you're seeing. Okay. I would say a very simple measure would be the size distribution of the vesicle, because I think it would be very distinct.
Yes.
These different classes. The size distribution, while it varies in eukaryotes, is highly peaked. I would say Gaussian, even, but yeah. uh, or
No, I agree. And anyway, the main difference is that those are located in the periplasm and they're in the cytoplasm. So there are important differences between those. There is no doubt about it. Yes.
I just want to make one comment about the tubes. That you don't need any special protein to form a tube. It's a natural solution of the membrane mechanics of lipid membrane. And so is a sphere, you know. Tubes connecting spheres is a very natural
totally
structure.
I propose that we continue this conversation. So Damien's here for several more weeks.
Two more weeks.
Mark Field, who he mentioned, is going to be here starting Thursday, and he's going to be here for many weeks. And Joel Bass is going to be here next week. Just for that 1 week of next week. So I think some of these talks will come up again, and all of these maybe we can just sort of remember our questions. Anyway, and let's thank the Indian for